Hello, good morning. So we were talking about the weathering CO2 thermostat, a very, very nifty idea in earth sciences that helps to understand why the climate of the earth has been so stable over geologic time, that the sun has been getting hotter through time, and that's because that's what stars do when they make bigger atoms out of littler atoms, which is the nuclear fire in the sun. The whole thing sort of contracts and gets hotter, and so Carl Sagan came up with this paradox. He didn't call it the faint young sun catastrophe like the ultraviolet catastrophe. This was just a garden variety paradox instead of a full-blown catastrophe, but still it was a problem. And one explanation, sort of a poetical explanation for the stability of the Earth, is the Gaia hypothesis that came from a British geochemist named Jim Lovelock, who says that the whole biosphere of the Earth sort of functions as a super organism that kind of looks out for itself and takes care of itself. Anyway, that's what this silicate weathering CO2 thermostat, that's sort of how it fit into the big picture. But alas, on our sister planet Venus, the thermostat is broken. So why is it broken? Is it because there's no CO2 degassing on Venus? Or could it be that there's no weathering? Or could it be there's no carbon or no oxygen or no water? What shall it be? So yeah, you've got both of the right answers there are sort of standing out. There is no weathering because there is no water. Venus was close enough to the sun that when water evaporated, it never hit the part of the phase stability diagram for H2O where it forms liquid or ice. And so you could just keep putting more and more vapor into the air and it would never reach the part of the system where it would rain or snow. So that was a runaway greenhouse effect on poor Venus. And once the water gets into the upper atmosphere, it gets zapped by ultraviolet light, and you lose the hydrogen to space, and it's gone forever. So there's no water on Venus, so no water, no weathering. The chemical reaction, just to refresh our memories, looks like that. And weathering is going forward. Backward is metamorphism. And you remember that the deep part of the planet is hot. This is sort of the hot side. If it's hot, the CO2 wants to be free as a gas. And so in hot conditions, it sort of favors this part of the chemical reaction. In cold or cool conditions, it sort of wants to be over here as these sedimentary rocks. So yeah, that's the thing about Venus. The silicate weathering thermostat on Mars is also broken. And why is that? If we're going to be a planetary mechanic and diagnose the issue, is it because of degassing or weathering or carbon or oxygen or water? Yeah, that's it. You got it. Mars is a smaller planet than Earth, and so it cooled down more quickly than Earth did. So we still have volcanoes on Mars. There are volcanoes on Earth. There are volcanoes on Mars, but they're dead. They're the largest volcano in the solar system is Olympus Mons, and it's there, but it doesn't. There's nothing coming out of it. Mars is sort of tectonically dead. So if there's no degassing, that means that the cool end member can win. There's nothing kind of breaking up the carbon into free gas again. So the silicate weathering thermostat on Earth will break. When? We run out of carbon, run out of water, sun gets too hot, the sun gets too cold, or basically never. What shall we say? I'm not a sports fan. If I've insulted anybody, I'm doing it out of ignorance, you know. consider the source and forget it. So stars get brighter as they age, don't they? That's the faint young sun paradox going into the past. So switching that around into the future would be the hot old sun paradox. What happens to the Earth? The sun gets hotter and hotter. As the sun gets warmer, I think we had a quick clicker question about this last time. If the sun is hotter, the CO2 concentration drops. Because if the sun gets hotter, the Earth gets hotter, and you start to have more weathering, and so you take CO2 out of the air faster than it's coming out from volcanoes, it's kind of like if you were to put some Drano down the drain of your sink analogy. If the drain was kind of sluggish and then you make it go faster, or you get the hair off the filter or whatever and let it go down faster, the water level in the sink in the steady state goes down to a lower level, right? And that's what happens when the sun gets hotter. It makes it faster to weather, so the CO2 drops. So the idea is that the CO2 is sort of dropping through geologic time. The sun is getting hotter, the CO2 is dropping, and at some point, you take off all the clothes you can, and then you're just hot. You can't take off anymore. CO2 in the air goes down and down and down, and when it reaches a low enough value, it can't get any lower, and so then the Earth just has to heat up, and eventually the Earth would have a runaway greenhouse effect, and this will be in a billion years or something like that. It's nothing to worry about for the near term. So the weathering thermostat on Earth will save us from global warming. That's choice A. Or B, it won't save us because it relies on volcanoes. Or it won't save us because the way we use the land affects weathering anyway. It kind of screwed everything up. Or it won't save us because it's too slow. Or it won't save us because it doesn't pay any attention to all the other greenhouse gases, methane and freons and sulfur hexafluoride and N2O and things like that. So what do we think? Ah, you guys are right on. Yeah, it's too slow. 100,000 years, 500,000 year time constant for stabilizing the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere. It's not a way to, if something pays off in 500,000 years, it's sort of not a way to manage an investment portfolio or, the planet of the Earth. And so you will be learning, you'll be running models to play with this, and you'll see the long time constant in lab this week. Okay. There's one more I want to ask you, and this is one, the answer to which you are blissfully and innocently unaware, because it's what we're going to talk about today. So I want to see if how good you guys are at guessing. So Lovelock, the Gaia hypothesis, Jim Lovelock, described the biosphere as a giant battery. And it was made out of two ingredients. Were they oxygen in the air and CO2? Or choice B is oxygen in the air and organic carbon? Or CO2 in the air and calcium carbonate rocks? D, CO2 in the air and igneous rocks? Or igneous rocks and calcium carbonate. If you're going to make a giant sort of Gaia battery, how would you do it? Take a wild guess. It turns out that the battery of the biosphere is all about organic carbon and food. So that would be choice B. We have this chemical reaction here. This is the Urey reaction. And it's an astonishing thing because the element carbon is essentially stabilizing the climate of the whole planet. It's an astonishing thing. This chemical reaction is a big deal. I'm going to write you now another chemical reaction, which is different from this first one, but it's just as astonishing, maybe even more so. And it goes like this. CO2 plus water plus energy goes to make CH2O plus oxygen. So just like calcium silica trioxide, CaSiO3, is like a ridiculously oversimplified formula for an igneous rock. Well, in the same way, this CH2O is a ridiculously oversimplified formula for organic carbon, for living carbon. So the word organic comes from life. The word org is you know, the root is life. And so it turns out that carbon that's sort of in something like this form is called organic even if it came out of an oil well or, you know, from a chemical plant. So there's like different uses of the word organic among, you know, people at the grocery store. Organic means that the bananas were grown without pesticides or, you know, growth hormones or whatever. And that's completely different from the way a chemist uses the word organic, which means that it is in this sort of a form that has sort of hydrogens on it, as opposed to CO2, which is an oxidized form of carbon, which means that it has oxygen. It's just totally bonded with oxygen. So this transition of the carbon from CO2 to an organic carbon is part of it's a chemical transformation called oxidation reduction of the carbon. So actually going in the direction of photosynthesis here, which is what this chemical reaction is. Did I forget to mention that? We're going from an oxidized form of carbon to a form of carbon which is more reduced. And oxidation and reduction is all about electrons. So carbon can be oxidized and reduced. Metals can be oxidized and reduced. So if your fender on your car is rusting out, that's because the metal iron is being oxidized. It's the same kind of chemistry. And it's all about electrons. It's sort of an accounting of electrons. So the element oxygen is sort of one of the principal players of this. The element oxygen is very greedy for two electrons. So in a CO2 molecule, so remember it's this linear molecule, wiggles and can be a greenhouse gas. Each of these oxygens are kind of pulling two electrons that it's sharing with carbon toward the oxygen. So they're very greedy. It sort of pulls. And so each one has two extra electrons on this oxygen and on this oxygen. And so each electron has a negative charge. So this is sort of like has a minus two sort of a charge to it, each oxygen. And then the overall molecule has no charge. So the carbon in the middle has to have a charge called an oxidation state. of plus 4. So that carbon in that CO2 molecule has essentially given off 4 electrons, and the oxygens have them. And so it's kind of like got this plus 4 charge to it. Now, the other element in this that sort of plays this redox game is hydrogen. So oxygen is greedy for 2 electrons. Hydrogen is very loose with its 1 electron. So if the way to make a compound reduced, which is the opposite of oxidized, is to bond it with hydrogen instead of oxygen. And the most reduced carbon you can get is actually methane. So let's put this here. Make a little box. CH4, methane. This is the most, quote, reduced form of carbon. So each hydrogen on the methane has given up 1 electron, because it's very loose with it. It let it go. And it's only got the 1. So each one, if you get rid of something that has a negative charge, what's left over is a positive charge. So each one has plus 1, and there's 4 of them. So it's like 4 plus charges on that, on those hydrogens. And the carbon, therefore, has an oxidation state of minus 4. So in order to go all the way from CO2 to CH4, you'd need 8 electrons. There's a, you know, you're going from being short 4 to having 4 extra. And because this number is lower than this one, this is a negative number, minus 4, they call this reduced. So that's where this word reduced comes from. Oxidized kind of makes sense kind of by just intuition, because it's got oxygen. This looks like an oxidized carbon. Or if you've got oxidized iron on your car, that's an iron oxide, you know, Fe, the iron bonded to oxygen. So oxygen, you kind of don't really have to be much of a chemist to understand. Reduced is a little trickier because it's all about these electrons, and you sort of have to follow where they're going and see that this is an oxidized carbon with a plus charge, then reduced has a very low charge like that. So are there any questions? Yes. Yes. So well, this one, for example, here this oxygen has a minus 2 charge, and there's 2 times a plus 1 charge on these 2 hydrogens, and so the oxygen here, or the carbon in this CH2O has an oxidation state of 0. So this is right in between this most oxidized and this most reduced form. A little more in the way of sort of backstory here may be helpful. Carbon has 4 electrons in its outermost shell, and it wants 8 to be complete. So it wants 4 bonds. So hydrogen can come in. Each hydrogen can donate a bond or an electron. And then there's 2 that make this chemical bond. So you can do it with hydrogens. You can do it with oxygens. there's always four bonds to carbon. So they talk about fats in food. So fats are these strings of carbon, and a saturated fat is one where there's as many atoms hanging off of that thing as you can possibly get. So this would be a 5-carbon chain, and if you put hydrogens so that all the carbons have 4 bonds, it will give you a good workout for your writing muscles. And this is a saturated hydrocarbon, or a saturated fat. If we were to take away some of these hydrogens, you could have a double bond here. So now each carbon still has 4 bonds. Each bond brings 1 electron. It needs 4 electrons to be happy, so it needs 4 bonds to be happy. So carbon with 4 hydrogens is as reduced as it can get, because it's getting 1 electron from each of these hydrogens. Or with 2 oxygens is as oxidized as it can get, because then it's giving away all 4 of its outer electrons, and that's all it has to give. So yeah, CO2 to methane is sort of the full spectrum of oxidized versus reduced for carbon. Yeah. It can. It does that in the atmosphere, but it's very unstable. These are called radicals, and they're very reactive compounds that form when sunlight hits them, and when, say, the methane that is released gets broken down, it does that by way of these radicals. It's the same kind of chemistry as happens in a candle flame. You get this sort of, all kinds of normal order of molecules kind of breaks down, and you get these weird things like carbon with 3 bonds to it. But there's not stable things that have different numbers of bonds in it. Okay, so this photosynthesis reaction then, sort of coming back to where we started, it takes oxidized carbon and it makes reduced carbon out of it. And there are 2 reasons why plants do this. One, because reduced carbon stores energy. So that's why it takes sunlight to drive photosynthesis, to make a plant out of CO2 from the air, is because it takes energy to do that. And the plant can then use this energy that's stored in that reduced carbon. It can get the energy back out. That reaction goes the other way. That's called respiration. And that's what we do, because we don't photosynthesize. All we do is eat reduced carbon that was grown for us by some plant, and then we actually combine it with oxygen to release CO2, which we exhale and get energy from. So one of the 2 reasons why plants do this photosynthesis is to store energy. And then the other is that carbon has a much more versatile chemistry. If you have it in sort of an intermediate oxidation state like this. So sugars are sort of big structures made out of subunits that look a lot like CH2O. Fats are more reduced. They're mostly carbons and hydrogens. And then DNA has got carbon backbones with other elements. I mean, all the incredible chemistry of life sort of relies on the versatile chemistry of carbon. And oxidized carbon, I mean, the Urey reaction with the calcium, the igneous rock and the calcium carbonate, that was all oxidized carbon. And that was pretty intriguing enough, but you know, the chemistry of life is just an astonishing thing. If there are any hardcore atheists among you, take a biochemistry class and it'll challenge your faith. It's an astonishing thing. Okay, so just that it all, you know, could work so well. It's just an amazing. All right. So we've got this photosynthesis that happens on Earth that creates this this organic material. And most of the trees and plants that grow, most of the photosynthesis that ever happens in the Earth goes right back to the low energy, but gets eaten, gets respired, rather than sort of building up on this side. But there is some small fraction of the organic carbon that grows every year that gets somehow isolated and prevented from back reacting and from getting eaten. So most of the carbon that gets removed like this is buried in the oceans, actually. And when you do that, when you make organic carbon and then bury it, sequester it, hide it someplace, you leave behind oxygen in the atmosphere. And that's where the oxygen in the atmosphere comes from. It's not, you know, coming from the planet, didn't come here on comets or something like that. It doesn't really belong there. If you were to kill all the life on the planet, the oxygen would eventually find enough of this organic material that it would go to zero and the atmosphere would be anoxic. That's sort of Lovelock's battery of the biosphere kind of running down. So he envisions us as like these Energizer bunnies with one electrode up in the oxygen in the air and the other, you know, deep in a ham sandwich. That's our battery. That's how we get our energy and sort of drive ourselves. A lot of times you hear about the rainforest being the lungs of the planet because, you know, the plants are growing there, and when they grow, they release this oxygen. The thing about rainforests and other forests on land is that you don't really accumulate much organic carbon over the long term. Rainforest stuff decomposes so quickly. As soon as a tree falls, the fungus start to eat it and decompose it, and it very quickly turns back to CO2, and so the oxygen that was released when the tree grew gets consumed again. So the rainforest is not really the lungs of the planet. If we cut down the rainforest, doesn't mean we're all going to asphyxiate from lack of oxygen. Most of the organic carbon that has gotten buried in the sediments is buried in the oceans, not on land. There are there's carbon in soils. And then there's peat deposits in high latitudes that can sort of accumulate and last for tens of thousands of years or something like that. But to really, really get rid of organic carbon, to really flush it away, you gotta kind of store it in sediments of the ocean and get rid of it that way. So most, actually, of the organic carbon on Earth that has, you know, accumulated over the history of the Earth was originally buried in ocean sediments, but has now, they're sort of ocean sediments on continental crust. So there's sedimentary rocks all over the continents. The continents basically float higher in the sort of mantle of the ocean than the ocean crusts do. So the ocean crust is intrinsically sort of underwater and deeper. So think of this as a block of continental crust. And it's fairly thick, and it floats fairly high up. And here's the ocean crust, and it's thinner, and so it floats lower. And usually, you know, we think of the ocean as kind of filling up and covering the ocean crust and not the continental crust. But sometimes there are sort of low parts of the continental crust that get covered over in sediments or in ocean, and then make these sort of ocean sediments. Even though it's on sort of on continental crust. And then the ocean crust does this subduction trick. So the ocean crust is all fairly new on the Earth. The ocean crust is never more than 100 million years or something like that, whereas the Earth is 40 times older than that, 4 billion years old. So the place to put ocean sediments where you can keep them for a long time is to sort of accumulate them on the continental crust. So the rocks under bedrock here are all sedimentary rocks. They're all carbonate rocks. So the water that we have here in Chicago is fairly hard. It has lots of dissolved calcium carbonate in it. So the organic carbon that has been buried over geologic time, leaving behind oxygen in the atmosphere, is mostly found in sort of ocean sediments located in on blocks of continental crust. So Lovelock made the argument that the Earth functions as a single organism that sort of looks out for its own best interest, in part because of the temperature stability, but we've kind of talked about that, but also because of the oxygen stability. So for the longest time in Earth history, for most of Earth history, there wasn't any oxygen in the atmosphere. And then somebody learned how to do, some bacteria learned how to do this trick of photosynthesis that released oxygen. Earlier photosynthesis had used a different chemistry, and so it didn't do this. But when this oxygenic photosynthesis was developed by cyanobacteria, I've heard this called the biggest environmental pollution event in the history of the Earth, because oxygen is a very it's a very reactive gas, and it has to be carefully controlled if you're going to have it near organic carbon, like your muscles and tissues and everything, because it wants to react you. It wants you to be CO2. You're not in equilibrium being a reduced carbon being. And most of the life forms that were on Earth at the time had, they got chased down into the darkest corners, deep into sediments and places where there was no oxygen by this oxygen that got released by this photosynthesis. So it's as if some bacteria or something today learned how to make a living by releasing chlorine gas to the atmosphere. So something in some evil critter in the ocean take sodium chloride, which is sea salt, and makes chlorine gas, and then everybody, has to go and hide underground someplace for the rest of time. That's kind of like what this was like, this release of oxygen as organic carbon from this oxygenic photosynthesis got buried. Actually, there is most of the buried organic carbon reacted with other chemicals in the Earth system before it started accumulating as free oxygen in the atmosphere. So iron, for example. So iron in an anaerobic form in anaerobic water, iron is soluble. So there was iron dissolved in the ocean just like sea salt. And it, you know, didn't not a whole lot happened to it. It just kind of flowed around. But when you react it with oxygen, it starts to form rust, which is very insoluble, iron oxide. So it goes from this soluble form to these sort of rust belts around the world. They're called banded iron formations. And most of the iron that we mine comes from these rust deposits on the edges of oceans from when oxygen started to be released. And it sort of was rusting the biosphere. It was rusting all the iron that was in the ocean. And so the oxygen was released and released and released until all the iron that could get rusted got rusted. And sulfur is another compound that that formed an it consumed a lot of the oxygen that was released. And so the sulfur now is in a form called sulfate in the ocean. So it's now like sea salt and doesn't really do all that much. It just kind of floats around like iron did before. But the funny thing is that this chemical reaction produced organic material enough to rust all the iron and to oxidize all the sulfate, and then to build up about something like our 20% oxygen in the atmosphere. And then it sort of stopped getting any higher. So this is where Lovelock has a point. There is some sort of a regulation mechanism. There's no obvious reason, you know, why we shouldn't be burying more organic carbon in the sediments and releasing more oxygen to the atmosphere. But we sort of know that this has never happened, that if oxygen got to be 10 times its present concentration, slightest spark would just burn and burn and burn and never go out until you ran out of, you know, continent or something like that. All the trees on a continent could burn in such a world. And we know that that's never happened. So there does seem to be a sort of a stabilizing mechanism. And it sort of has something to do with the oxygen in the atmosphere and the burial of organic carbon. So we've got oxygen in the air enough that there's O2 in the ocean. Then when you make organic carbon by photosynthesis, which can happen on land or it can happen in the surface of the ocean. It has to have sunlight, so you can't do photosynthesis at the bottom of the ocean in the dark. It has to be sort of at the top. But when you do it and this stuff sinks down into the deep ocean, it can react with O2 to make CO2 again. So the oxygen in the ocean is sort of preventing organic carbon from accumulating anymore. But if the oxygen in the atmosphere drops down, if this gets too low, then the ocean can become anoxic. In which case, it gets harder to do this respiration reaction, and the organic carbon is just buried. And when you make organic carbon, you make oxygen. And if you don't respire the organic carbon again, then you've built some oxygen in the atmosphere. So oxygen in the atmosphere gets too low, ocean gets anoxic. More organic carbon gets buried, and this leaves O2 in the atmosphere. So it's another sort of a stabilizing thing, like a negative feedback, like we talked about for the carbon cycle. This one is not as well understood. I have to be honest with you. the stability of atmospheric oxygen still seems kind of spooky to me. I mean, it sort of makes sense that if the atmosphere gets, I mean, this mechanism sort of makes sense in a qualitative sort of way, but there aren't sort of models that have, you know, that can reproduce the stability of the oxygen in the atmosphere. Is still kind of a mysterious question. So now where we're going with this is that fossil fuels are actually this organic material. And just like the Energizer Bunny with one finger in a ham sandwich and the other in the oxygen in the air, this is what we're doing with, to get energy from fossil fuels. We're digging up this organic material and reacting it with oxygen, doing essentially the same thing as a respiration reaction to get this energy back. And you might wonder to yourself if, you know, by tapping out the biosphere of the battery, the battery of the biosphere, if that means that we're going to asphyxiate ourselves by running out of oxygen. And the answer to that, happily, is no, that the vast majority of this organic stuff that's buried in you know, the continental crust, the sedimentary rocks on the continental crust or sediments in the ocean, is in a form that's just not very convenient to use as a fuel. So what we'll talk about next time is what forms of carbon are usable as fuel: coal, oil, and gas. And most of the organic carbon, like if you go and look at the limestone buildings on the campus, those rocks, those limestone rocks, are mostly calcium carbonate, but they may have a few percent, maybe a tenth of a percent or a half a percent or something, organic carbon in them. And so theoretically, you could burn that organic carbon with oxygen, get energy out, but in a practical sense, it's all buried, it's all caught up in that rock, and it's inconvenient to use. And that's the way most of the carbon on Earth is. So it's only very special carbon deposits that are now available to us as fossil fuels. So we'll talk about those on Wednesday.